What up, guys? What up, what up, what up? It's your girl, Brooklyn. I am coming to you guys, actually, out of my kitchen tonight. And I'm making baked spaghetti. Because Alex wanted baked spaghetti. It has been such a dope week. I'm getting ready to go into another week. I'm probably going to go ahead and publish this tonight. Shout out to all the young ladies who got on board and started eating healthy and changed just the little things, you know, about yourself. Little eating habits will change a lot, you know. Take baby steps. You didn't get overweight overnight. You're not going to lose it overnight. It's just what it is. The things that you like, just tweak it, you know. Like right now, I'm making baked spaghetti, but rather than using ground beef, I'm using ground turkey. Like, just little things. Little things make a big difference, you know? Don't beat yourself up so bad. Don't do that, because it'll start making you feel, you start feeling worthless and all those things, and that depression start kicking in, and we getting away from that. We are getting away from that. Oh, I'm telling y'all, my stuff about to be so good, y'all. I'm sorry, I got my whole house smelling. Yes, yes, yes. But, so tonight, what I'm going to talk to you guys about, I have been getting so many messages about, especially my black women with depression that's not being treated. I want to talk about that. Because if you're not treating it medically, you're treating it some type of way. You just don't realize what it is. So, I remember, this is before I was even diagnosed with depression and anxiety. But I can think back to when I was 16, and by this time I had a son, my oldest son, we call him Man. And one night, he went up to Boston to go visit, and I was in Atlanta, right? So he was up there visiting. While he was up there visiting, I was supposed to go back on New Year's, and he was up there for Christmas. So he's up there, and during that time, my son... Someone broke my son's leg, broke 5 of his ribs, 3 ribs on one side, 3 on the other. He had shaken baby syndrome, and he was hit with something hard and metal in the back of his head and then laid in his crib. By the time the ambulance got to him, they had to life flight him to Boston Medical Center, where he stayed on life support for almost 60 days, if I'm not mistaken. It might be a little bit over there. Now, mind you, I'm 16 at this time. I want you to keep that in mind while I'm telling you the story, that I'm a child dealing with this, okay? So that trauma alone, just having a baby at 16, getting pregnant at 15, not having nowhere to go, nobody, no support system at all, and then having a baby at 16, going from place to place to place, and then this happens. Well, by the time I was 16, I was dating somebody maybe 10, 15 years older than me. I thought I was growner than what I was, because I was doing grown women stuff. I was working jobs and going to school and taking care of my son, and you know, I thought I was grown, even though mentally you're still not as mature as you think you are. So I just kept going and kept going every night. So let me get back to the story. So you guys, y'all know my ADHD be kicking in. I ain't on live, so my cousin anime can't like direct me right now. So let me get back to the story. So when it happened, I was in Atlanta. And my dad had just bought a house. And we had just moved in the house. And so we didn't even have phone service. So the hospital in Boston had to call DeKalb County Police Department and have them come to my parents' house, my dad's house. So it's 3 o'clock in the morning, 4 o'clock in the morning, police come to the door. And I don't know what it was, but I knew it was bad. And I could see the front door from my bedroom, and my stepmother opened up the door. And the way she looked at me, it was just like I knew something really bad had happened. And when I got there, and I got to the door, the police officer was like, do you have a son in Boston? And I was like, yeah. He was like, do you know somebody in Boston? And I was like, yeah, my son is up there. And he was like, you need to call Boston Medical Center right now. I was like, I don't have a phone. And so that police officer let me use his phone. I need to pull that police report one day so I can find out who that was, because he was so confident. I need to, like, really tell him I remember him every time I tell this story. But so he let me call. And when I called, the doctor who performed my son's surgery, and I'm going to get to that, his name is Dr. Ordia. He didn't let anybody else talk to me. He got on the phone and he said, Mom, I need you to get to the hospital. Well, during this time, my boyfriend's mom was calling me. And she told me, the first thing she said to me is, we went in the room to go wake up man, and he wouldn't wake up. I lost it. Completely lost it. So Dr. Ordia was like, I asked him, I said, is my son still alive? He said, yes, but the surgery that, the injury that he had at this time, it wasn't popular to have, that surgery wasn't as popular. Man had what's called a hematoma. And if you're in the medical field, you know that is like almost the absolute worst head injury you can have. And now imagine that on a 10-month-old baby. Well, at that time, only two people had had the surgery, a woman and a man. Both had passed away. And Dr. Ordia, that was the first, my son was the first one that he had did it on a child. And this was all the way back in 1997, okay? So I'm telling my age, right? But in 1997. So he did the surgery on my son. He had to give him, half of my son's head is a scar. He had to open him up completely to drain the blood. They had to cast his whole body because his ribs were broken and his leg was broken. So, again, let's go back to I'm 16, okay? So now, I'm trying to figure out how I'm going to get to Boston because it's right in the middle of a snowstorm. I don't have anybody. I don't have any money. I don't have anything. I don't have nothing. And because I'm a child. And I didn't have anybody to help me. I didn't have anybody to, you know, just come to my aid. And, you know, I didn't have the support system that a lot of people have. And so I didn't. But my real mother, she was in Massachusetts at the time. And I don't know, I can't remember if I called her or if somebody else called her. But anyway, she knew. She found out what happened. Maybe my older sister called her. I can't remember. But she called me. And one of her friends, Miss Linda, I love her to death. If you ever listen to my podcast, just know I owe you so much. I can't wait to see you one day. Me and my son, I just want to hug you for helping me. But I couldn't fly because all the flights going out, you couldn't get out. Hold on, y'all. I know I got some fettuccine somewhere. See, here go my ADHD. Okay, so yeah. So the flights, that's linguine, no. So the flights were out. You couldn't fly. So I had to take a Greyhound bus. And I got on the Greyhound. My stepmother took me to the Greyhound station in downtown Atlanta. And when I got there, I had one bag of clothes and she handed me a Bible. Now, as I tell people, sometimes you gotta have an experience with God in order to be a believer. It's very hard to explain it, but until you have an experience and an encounter with him, and that's when my relationship started. I was 16. And she gave me the Bible, and I got on the bus, and the whole time I was headed up there, I was just reading the Bible, you know, like I was like flipping through it, going back and forth, flipping through it, just trying to, you know, get away with time or whatever. And so anyway, we ended up making it to Boston. It took 24 hours to get from Atlanta to Boston on the bus, and made it to Boston. Got there. My mom and Miss Linda was there. They came to pick me up and took me straight over to the hospital. Now, during this time, it wasn't popular for teenage girls to have babies. You were immediately deemed unfit because of your age alone. They felt like, you know, something had to be wrong with you because you're irresponsible. You're this, you're that, you're this, you're that, because of your age. And like now, it's nothing for a 16-year-old to have 2-3 kids. You know, when I was coming up, I was rare. That didn't happen. Or you didn't. It wasn't as flaunted. So when I got to the hospital, soon as I got there, everybody was there. It was like, and when I say everybody, I mean medical professionals. My son, they had like other doctors who were looking at him because they had performed the surgery that nobody had made it through. And now this child was the third one. And so they were coming in, like basically he was like almost like an experiment. They were coming in, looking at him. And so when I went in, they prepared me before I went in the room. And all of this is going to come back. All of this is going to meet up with mental health in a minute, okay? And what I want you guys to mean by you mask it, okay? If you ain't helping it medically, you still are masking it with something, right? So anyway, I hear my cousin in my ear like, okay, back on track. So they take me in a room and they put my son's, like a CAT scan. It's like a picture of the brain. And they put it up on the screen so I could see, so Dr. Ordia could explain to me exactly what was wrong with my son. And he was like, this is what's wrong. He had a massive, whoever hit him, when they put him inside of the crib and he laid down, all the blood, he had the hematoma. So my son has a fracture in the back of his head where he was hit. And then the side of his head, because they laid him down, all the blood had rushed to that side. So they wanted to prep me that when I went inside of the room, what I was going to see, right? So when I got in the room, my son was laying in bed and he was wrapped from head to toe. His head was so big, like it was almost like he had 3 heads, honestly. And I was like, wow. I looked at the doctor and I was like, is my son going to live? And he was like, we're going to know in the next 72 hours how, you know, some of the swelling will go down. We'll look at him again and we'll see what's going on. Well, fast forward, 72 hours go by, nothing happens, right? And fast forward again. Now they're coming in, they're testing, they're trying to see if he has brain waves, if he's breathing. And so he was in like almost like a vegetative state. So basically when they turned off the machines, he didn't breathe. So the machines was the only thing keeping him alive. So that went on for so long because guess what? Somebody going in that, because the mother is only 16. This child is costing thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars to keep this baby on life support. No, who's going to pay for it? State's going to pay for it. What's going to happen, you know? And so they, look, I had to turn my stereo down, y'all. I'm sorry. I've been here cooking and cleaning. It'd be a whole mood up in my apartment. But so anyway, they are like, okay, basically that's what it was coming down to. He didn't have insurance. We were in another state. The mom is not even of age. We need to start looking at this realistic. This child is not waking up. And the chances of him even having quality of life when he wakes up was very slim to none. They were like, I wasn't going to be able to take care of him in the state that he was going to be in. There was no way that I would be able to give him the care that he would need. And so they started fighting me. And they wanted me to turn man's machines off. And I refused. I was like, no. And one of the nurses, she's the one who told me, no matter how old you are, you're still his mother. They can't make you do anything. Not in the hospital. So I was like, okay. So every day I'm like, no. I'm not turning off the machine. This is my first. First of all, in my head, you got to think, even though I'm 16, this is my first child. My son was my absolute everything. Like, as soon as I had my son, it was grind time for me. I grinded like I was a 40-year-old. I was getting it. Like, I knew I was going to give my son a great life. And I knew that I was, like, my son was going to be somebody. And he was not going to have the childhood that I had. I was determined. And I was like, no, this is not how he's supposed to leave. Like, I just don't believe that. And so I kept telling them no. Well, lo and behold, it was like a Wednesday. Excuse me. It was a Monday. That following Monday came. And I'm sitting in my son's, because I was living in the hospital. I never left the hospital. I slept in my son's room, everything, never left the hospital. So I'm sitting in there, and a police officer comes to the door. He's like, "Are you Miss Bagley?" I'm like, "Yes." He hands me the paper. Well, it was a warrant, like a summons for me to come to court because they were going to make me turn my son's machines off because he had no life without breathing machines. So basically, because the mom is saying, "No, we're going to force it." And so I fought them teeth and nail, but it didn't matter. And they were doing it quick. It was Monday, and I was supposed to be in court Thursday morning at 9 o'clock. Me and my mother were like, I just fell apart. I have never, it's something about a weep and a cry when you calling out to Jesus for real. Like when it's authentic and it's real, like I didn't even know I could ask for mercy in such a broken way. Like I can't describe it to you. And so I'm just over my son. And this is the very first time that I had ever prayed even on my own. And I was just like, I didn't even know how to pray. I grew up in church, but I didn't even know like how to pray or what to say. I was just begging him. Like I was at his mercy. Like, please wake my son up. And so every day, Tuesday come, nothing happened. I'm sitting there like, "Miss Bagley, please go shower, go, you know, go do something. You have to go eat. I'm like, "No, I'm not leaving my son. Not leaving." So Tuesday comes. He starts having like little movement in his leg. And the nurse told me it was because of his nerves. Like even when someone dies, they'll move. Sometimes they'll sit up, they'll vomit, they'll, you know, whatever. And so I was like, okay, so like basically don't get your hopes up, basically. And so Tuesday night comes, my mom is there with me. She came up there and he had some more movement again that night, but this time like in his hand. And I'm like, "What's going on? Like, would he be moving that much?" And she's like, "Nikki," like she's just trying to be mindful because she don't want her child to get too hopeful, you know, that something has happened. But I was just like, see, when you believe in something, when you done prayed about something, and you believe, you really believe that it's going to work, you know, like it's going to happen, if something else comes over you. And I can't really tell you what it was because I was so young, but I felt something different. It's a difference to feel the presence of the Lord. It's a difference to know that he is. I can tell you when he's in the room with me. Like, it's just I can't explain it. And so I told my mom, I was like, "Man's gonna wake up. Keep going." So kept going. She's supportive as she can be, you know, and like, cause now her grandchild, her oldest grandson, is laying here on life support, and her daughter is 16 and she's going through her own issues. So she's trying to comfort me as best she can. So I'm there and I'm, you know, next day comes. So Wednesday comes. Let me tell y'all, it's like 11 o'clock at night. My mom was like, "You need to go eat." I was like, I'm not leaving him. So my mom goes to ask the nurse lady for something to eat. So she give me something to eat. Da-da-da. My mom left and she went home. Because she lived, I was in the city of Boston. I was at Boston Medical Center. And my mom, she lived in the outskirts of a place called Lowell, Massachusetts. And so she had to go back, like, out of the city. So she goes back. And I'm sitting there with my child. And I just wept and cried and prayed and wept and cried and prayed. I didn't eat for days. I fasted for days. From the time they told me that Monday, I couldn't eat anything. I couldn't drink anything. I couldn't, nothing. All I knew to do was pray. Couldn't. Went to sleep. Ended up going to sleep. I fell asleep on man's bed. And I woke up at like 12:22. It was like 12:22. His machine started going off. And I'm like, "Why is this machine going off?" And I'm looking and the nurse comes in. And I'm like, "Why is that happening?" And she's like, "No, it's okay." She reset it and she walked out. I laid my head back down. The machine started going off again. She comes back in. She looks. Man starts reaching for me. He starts reaching. Like, like, I hear my mom. Like, I know, like, it's like he knew I was there. The lady, she was like, Miss Bagley, get up, move, move. And they did something, and then all these doctors started coming in there, and all these nurses and everybody came into my son's room, and they trying to make me come out of the room, and I'm like, oh no, I'm not going nowhere. I'm here for this. We here for all of this right now. So they go in, and Dr. Ordia, he was still on call. He was still on call, and he came in, and he told me, he grabbed me by my shoulder. He said, stand right here. Okay. Went in there, looked at man. He looked at me, and he was like, he's woke. And that's how my son woke up. My son woke up out of this surgery that they said nobody had ever made it through. He wasn't going to do this. I have to get into the story later about, you know, all the things they said he wasn't going to be able to do. He was going to have a limp, and he wasn't going to be able to see, and he was going to have, you know, speech impediments because the brain was so damaged. And if you know my son right now, you know he a whole boss and ain't nothing wrong with him. So, but I'll walk you guys through that another time. But what I told you that story because I want to fast forward to when we left the hospital. I put myself back in foster care because I had been in foster care before. So I put myself back in foster care so that way I could have insurance and I could have somewhere to live while my son stayed in the hospital. So I knew the system and I knew how to use the system. So that's what I did. And I stayed there. I had to stay there because my son was, even though he woke up, he still stayed in the hospital for another like 2 months. Well, during this time, the social service people was like, she's 16. Like, even though this child is woke and this is her child, she's not going to be able to care for this child. And do you know, them people tried to take me to court to take my baby. I'm not playing. I had never, now mind you, when I went through my son dying pretty much in my face and coming back, and then you telling me because of my age that I'm not fit to raise my son. Nothing else, no other reason, just my age. So they had this child psychologist do an interview with me, and she was asking me questions, and they did like this mental thing, I guess thinking that something was going to come back. And I'm going to tell you how God worked, because when we got inside of the courtroom, the lady, she said, she's 16, but she is a grown woman. She is so responsible. We have watched her. I have never seen a young lady who is so organized and so neat and cares for her son so much. Like, she does better than some of the adult parents who have, you know, like of age parents, you know, who had kids. Like, I didn't even expect for her to say that about me, because I'm like, they looking for a reason. And so she was like, I cannot recommend that this child be taken from his mom. The judge was a black judge. And I'm going to tell you, I'm to keep telling you how God worked. God hand all up in this, right? The judge who had to make the decision was the same judge who put me in foster care. He was like, don't I know you? I said, yes, sir. He was like, come on up here again. And I had to tell y'all that story. That's a whole nother story, right? So he was like, he went through everything, looked to see that, you know, I had never been in trouble. I was a good girl. I had good grades. I had, you know, never in any trouble. I was a good kid. And he was like, unless y'all can give me a valid reason why this child needs to be taken from his mom, like, this is over. Nobody could say anything. I left the courthouse. I didn't even go get my clothes. I left the courthouse, went straight to the airport, to JFK Airport, and flew my butt back to Hartsville in Atlanta. And my dad picked me up, and I came back. Now, when I got back, they told me, Miss Bagley, you're going to have to see somebody. You need to see a therapist, because you can't go through that type of trauma and not deal with it, because things come from that. This is a huge trauma, and, you know, even adult people would have a hard time with what you've been through. You need to go talk to somebody. I went one time. I didn't like the lady, and I was like, I'm not going back. Never went back. Now, I'm going through all these depression spells in the morning. Like, I'm crying. And I'm thinking, okay, well, I'm crying for no reason like this, because it's okay. I'm supposed to feel this way, right? I'm supposed to feel like this. Y'all know my sessions ain't but 30 minutes, right? So I'm at 24.41, okay? So it's gonna get through this. But, so, I didn't know why I was feeling that way. I was always anxious. My thoughts was always racing. Like I couldn't focus on one thing. I couldn't, you know, but my depression was so bad. I couldn't bathe. It was so bad. Like it made my skin hurt, but I kept going. I still never went and seen anybody, but I still masked it because as soon as I needed something to make me feel good. I was like, I need something. As soon as I got back, I ended up getting into a relationship. Now, mind you, the relationship was not, the person was not bad. It's actually my son's father, but the person was not bad. But what I want you to get from this is that's what happened. Like, I thought I could fill it with something else. Like, I feel this void. I feel this loneliness. I feel this hurt. I feel this pain. I need something to make me feel better. And that's what, and I started reaching out to other things, and men was one of them. And so relationships, not just men, like I've never been a promiscuous person, but even that relationship probably never should have happened considering everything I had just been through. And then on top of that, I started trying to build relationships with people just to feel accepted. Just to feel wanted, because you're going through all these abandonment issues. I done went through all this trauma with my son pretty much by myself. It was really, really hard. And you start building like all these toxic relationships and people around you just to make you feel better, to fill that hole and make you feel better. So I said that to say, when this happened, you guys, everybody know the story with my youngest two kids, when all the molestation happened with my boys. And I finally, this was the first time that I had ever been to a therapist, and a psychiatrist had actually evaluated me. And when they do that, you know, they go all the way back through your life and from the beginning. And my psychiatrist was like, wow. Like, not only does she need intense therapy because she should have been had therapy, but she needs everything. Like, we have to help her. Like, I was a complete wreck at that time. And I grew up where you don't take medication. You don't take medication. Everybody always trying to kill you. Everybody always trying to, you know, da da da. But I will tell you this, and I am a living witness, and this is why I encourage people to address their mental health. Until I got therapy, and until I started seeing my psychiatrist and my meds were given to me the right way, because I had to, of course, they got to adjust it to make sure it works, to make sure, you know, whatever. I have never felt so good in my life. I didn't even know what it felt like to feel normal because I had learned to live in my depression. I had learned to live in my anxiety. That was my normal. So when I actually started feeling good, I was like, oh my God, this is working. So now I'm 3 years in of therapy and my medication every day and making sure I'm like, and I'll go through like things you can do to organize and all that good stuff, you know, later. So to try to help you through your days and stuff like that. But the main thing that I want you to know is, even if you're not addressing, if you think you're not addressing it right now, you're addressing it with something: food, men, alcohol, weed, something. You are masking it with something. You have to get your mental health taken care of, because nothing is worse, and y'all and anybody who got depression know exactly where I'm coming from when I'm about to say this. Nothing is worse than being in the middle of the night and you there in the middle of the night by yourself and you in such a depressed mode that you can, like, it ain't even a considering, it's a choice. Does it even make sense for me to live right now? Like, it feels better to release that pain right now. And you know what I'm talking about if you live with depression, and especially if it's not treated. And the one thing about it, I will tell you this, at some point, everything else is not going to be enough. You can't continue to let that trauma just, you know, to let that trauma and that mental health just take over your life. You deserve to have a normal life. And if you need medication to do that, take your medication. I am team medication, because honey, I'm going to tell you. I tell everybody, I take my medication for me, and I take my medication for you, because I want everybody to have a good day, okay? And so, for everybody to have a good day, and for us not to have no issues throughout the day, let me make sure that that's the first thing I do in the morning. And literally, that is the first thing I do in the morning, because we want to be the best possible versions of ourselves. And baby, Y'all do not want that version of me when I am not, when my mental health is not treated. Yeah, think about the person in your family who got depression or got anxiety or real temperamental and all that stuff. That's the person you'll never want to talk to. Or you don't know how to console them because they always like in such a distressed stage and, you know, all of that. I'm going to talk about that one day, too. Like how you can, if you're the person, you know, who's caring for someone who has depression and anxiety, that's a hard role to be in when you don't know what to do. And this person is not getting treated. Like, yeah, treat your mental health, because you don't have to tell me that you masking it with something. I know you masking it with something. Mine was making having a body there and food. Which is how I got to 406 pounds. Eating. Because every time I ate, it felt good. I needed something to make me feel good. And the only time I got that feeling is if I was having sex or if I was eating. So that was my thing. These two things make me feel good. It make me feel, you know, like I feel safe. I feel, you know, and you're masking it with something. Get help. And because I really want you guys to be the best possible version of yourself. All right. So that's the wrap for me for today. I hope you guys are having a great weekend, or you had a great weekend. I want you to really, really have such a dope week coming up. Like really, really plan to have a great week. You know, I want you to go into the week knowing that this is going to be a good week. I want you to go into the week organized. I want you to write down what you need to do. You know, I want you to really, really focus. And if you are one of my listeners who are not getting your mental health treated, like I challenge you this week. I challenge you to make the appointment. Make the appointment. Start doing whatever you need to do to be the best possible version of you. All right, you guys, I gotta go. I'm in mommy mode. Be dope. I love you.